Greetings and may the peace of Christ be with you. Welcome to Holy Family Radio. This is Deacon Jim Thorndale and I'm privileged to be your host today. I warmly invite you to enter into another conversation in living the Catholic life. You know, when I look at our church, I see the beauty of the organizations of our church, how we have a beautiful magisterium and how it leads us in truth and faithfulness and teaching. And I've had the privilege in the last 30 days to be with three different bishops. I was with the Bishop of Rome, but I was about an arm length away from our Holy Father, Pope Francis. Just recently, I was at Parish in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Christ the King, and I was with Bishop Boyer on the altar because my cousin Paco Gavrilides, his son, was being confirmed, and he's my godson. But I have a special privilege today here in the studio because it's something we've been anticipating. We've got our bishop here, Bishop David Walkowiak from the Diocese of Grand Rapids. And Bishop, welcome. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome, Jim. Thank you.
It's a privilege to have you here. We've been anticipating getting you over here to kind of get to know you, have the diocese know you, the people listening in Holy Family Radio. But, you know, I found it probably something necessary. People need to know who you are, Bishop. So what I'm going to ask is maybe you can give us a little bit of a background on where you came from and how you got here to Grand Rapids.
Sure. I was born in East Cleveland, Ohio, and lived most of my life near the shores of Lake Erie in Ohio. And so I grew up on the west side of Ohio, a city called Westlake. Okay. I went to grade school at St. Bernadette's in Westlake, Ohio. I went to St. Ignatius High School in Cleveland on the west side. Okay. And then I went to the University of Notre Dame. So for 4 years, I was living in Indiana and got a degree there. And then from there, I went into the seminary. Cleveland has its own seminaries. And I entered St. Mary's Seminary right after college and was ordained the priest for the Diocese of Cleveland in 1979.
Okay. Can I ask you a question to go back a little bit? Were both of your parents Catholic?
Absolutely, very strong Catholics.
Okay.
And I think that you'll find in many cases, at least with my generation, that the faith of our mothers and fathers was so important in forming us to realize that God matters, the church matters, Christ matters.
Yeah.
And it really was not only my parents, but my sisters and my extended family that made it so easy and natural to really latch onto the faith and really see it as a treasure.
Yeah.
And that ultimately, I think, was one of my vocational incentives, was that my faith was so important to me that I really had to want to share it with others.
As you were growing up, were either one of your parents more instrumental in your growth in the faith than the other, or are they pretty much the same?
They were a team.
Okay.
They were very much a team. I don't ever recall missing Mass. They never did.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Even on vacations, we always found a church. And, of course, when you go on vacations in different states, it is kind of interesting to visit other parishes and see the different cultures and areas where we live and see how different parishes do things.
Exactly.
So it was always, it wasn't really a burden. It was just something that was so totally part of our Sundays that we very gladly, you know, worshiped wherever we found ourselves to be.
And growing up as a young boy, I'm sure it was kind of an eye-opener for you, and I remember for me, too, that going to a different Catholic church, even outside my state, it was the same Mass. And I think I had to see that for myself to get that understanding that this is a universal church. And that's kind of what you're saying, too, is that you saw that universality of the church everywhere you went, even on vacation.
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes people would describe themselves, you could tell where they live by they tell you what parish they were from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how important parish identity was. And, of course, even children who you may not know the names of streets have a general idea if you're from St. Luke's or from St. James or from wherever. You have an idea about the neighborhood and the schools because you play them in athletics. You may have played with them, for example, when school orchestras got together for a big concert or things like that. So there were really strong Catholic ties, and I hope that we can continue to develop that and create those in our own diocese.
Exactly. So here you are going to Notre Dame, got your degree, and then you're in seminary in Cleveland.
Right.
And what's the name of that seminary there?
St. Mary's Seminary.
St. Mary's.
When I was going to school there, it was in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. It was in the central city. And for the first 5 years that I taught as a faculty member, we were located in the central city. And then in 1991, because of low small numbers at our college seminary and our theologate. They decided to combine both seminaries on one campus out in Wycliffe, Ohio, which Borromeo Seminary is about 12 miles east of downtown Cleveland. And so for the next 15 years as a faculty member, I lived at what they call the Center for Pastoral Leadership, which housed not only the St. Mary's Seminary and Borromeo Seminary, but also the lay formation programs, the permanent diaconate, and things like that.
Okay. So you're there for 15 years.
On that campus, 20 years as a faculty member at the seminary.
Okay. So then obviously become a parish priest at some point. Is that correct?
Well, right out the gate, my first assignment was I was assigned to St. Mary's Parish in Lorain, Ohio.
Okay.
Which is right on Lake Erie, and we lived very close. It was a downtown parish, very close not only to the lake but to the Black River. And, of course, the river is where, you know, the ore carriers, the limestone carriers, would come upriver to get to U.S. Steel and also to American Shipbuilding in order to provide the raw materials needed for the industry in Lorain.
Okay. So you're over there, you're as a parish priest and on the faculty at the same time?
No, the first 3 years, 1979 to 1982, I was an associate pastor at the parish. And then in probably late 1981, Bishop Pilla, who is the bishop at the time, asked me to consider studying canon law. And after praying about it and whatnot, I had no good reason to say no. And so as a result, I agreed to do that. So after I left St. Mary's in Lorain, the parish, in 1982 in the summer, and then in the fall I started up at Catholic University. So after 3 years as an associate pastor, I spent the next 4 years at Catholic University getting a degree in canon law.
Okay.
And it was from after that then I was assigned to the seminary faculty and also to be part of the bishop's staff as vice chancellor.
Okay. So as you're beginning this personal journey through your... You're in a parish now as a priest before you're appointed to be a bishop. But how did that happen? How did that transpire? How did this all take place?
My assignment as associate pastor?
Well, that, and then when did you get notified that you were being considered for being the bishop of Grand Rapids?
Oh, well, that was easily 30 years later.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of water had flowed under the bridge, so to speak.
That's the journey I'm trying to find.
Well, we talked about the 3 years in Lorain, the 4 years at Catholic U. The next 20 years were spent as a faculty member at the seminary, dean of students for the last 8 years, also the vice chancellor of the diocese. So I was part-time on the bishop's staff answering canonical questions and dealing with canonical matters.
Okay.
And then, so after 20 years, I felt that was a nice round number, and I remembered that the reason I was attracted to the diocesan priesthood was to be a parish priest.
Yeah.
And I had always wanted to do that, and I felt that 20 years was a good long run, and it might be good for me to get back to parish work, and then good for the seminary to get some new blood in there teaching. And so I asked Bishop Pilla permission to apply for a parish so that I could rotate back into parish work. So that was after a 20-year run using my canonical background, both on the bishop's staff and as a teacher at the seminary.
Would he do that reluctantly, or was he?
He wanted to know what this was all about. I said, well, I'm not unhappy doing what I'm doing. I like the seminary work, and I like working in the chancery. I said, but, you know, I really wanted to be a parish priest. I says, I'm getting older. I'm in my early 50s, and I'm afraid that the longer I stay in these positions, the less I will be likely to go back into parish work. And there does come, you know, a loss of confidence. You just kind of, your nerve is not as steady. I had been away from parish life for 25 years.
Sure.
And so I had a very high estimate of my own pastoral abilities. And I can still remember after becoming pastor, after 3 weeks, I was thinking to myself, what was I thinking when I applied for this? Because it was a big parish, it had a day school, and life had changed in the parish since I had been in the parish back in Lorain. And very wonderfully, the people of St. Joan of Arc Church in Chagrin Falls, where I became pastor, were very wonderful in shaping me and helping me to become a pastor. and to become an effective pastor, I think. Yeah. So that was really very helpful. So the bishop, when I told him why I wanted to get back to parish work, he says, well, I think that's a good idea. And then he mentioned to me some of the parishes that would be coming available. So it was, I felt very good about that, because in the past I had always accepted assignments. Here was one that I was thinking about initiating an idea for an assignment on my own. And I was always wondering, is this my own personal desire, or is this what God wants? You know, I seem to be doing well with what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But when the bishop said, I think it's a good idea, and endorsed it, I was very relieved, and I felt very much affirmed that maybe, you know, the Lord was moving me to rotate out of seminary life and administrative life and get back to the very rich and diverse life of a parish.
Yeah. And I would think, Bishop, not being in your position, but I would think one of the hardest transitions would be is that while you're in the seminary, these young men are really looking up to you as a leader and the mentor in what they're doing. When you're in parish life, you have a lot of different people in there who are on different journeys. And so you probably have to, like I said, it's a challenge in a parish life to really incorporate all those different people into your thought process.
It's like being the mayor of a small village. I mean, you've got...
I like that.
If, you know, somebody thinks the sidewalk is uneven, they tell you about it.
Yeah.
You need to get pull some of those weeds in this flower bed. You know, I need the gym unlocked. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of very mundane things that can really scatter your day, but a lot of very profound moments, too.
Of course.
I mean, in terms of counseling, celebrating the sacraments, working with parish council, finance council. And, of course, there's a learning curve with all of these things. I mean, running a parish is like running a small business.
Exactly.
You know, your budget is over $1 million, mm-hmm. and you have human resources. You have 30 to 40 employees.
Yeah.
You become really a jack of all trades. You have to. And so that's why I really believe that one of the great gifts that was given to me in preparation for becoming Bishop of Grand Rapids was those 7 very wonderful and fulfilling years and learning years as pastor at St. Joan's in Chagrin Falls.
In seminary, Bishop, and even in your when you're at in seminary as an instructor, how equipped are most priests to really be leaders of a parish? It's not spiritually, but financially. I mean, how much savvy would they have in understanding the business aspect of it?
Some of them come with that background.
Okay.
For example, you know, the 2 deacons that we're going to be ordaining this coming Saturday are 43 years old and 45 years old. Mm-hmm. So they have been out in the marketplace. They've done things. They've lived for many years a similar life that other men in this society live. So they have a lot of them have personal experience from their careers, their work background. And, of course, the age of the priests this year, I think, was 35 and a half. The average age of a priest being ordained in the United States was about 35.
Wow.
I was ordained a priest at the age of 25.
Young man.
Right out of college, go right through the 4 years. That still happens, but it happens. We're getting more of a blend of people who feel a little bit, we say unfulfilled, or that there's more to life and their faith means more to them, and so they start looking about how they might serve the Lord. So as a result, I think that some of our seminarians already have that. They bring it with them. The younger ones don't, of course.
Yeah.
And what the younger ones are interested in is developing the skills that will help them immediately as a priest.
Exactly.
For example, when I was a instructor at the seminary, I offered a course on, you know, parish management, mm-hmm. you know, the canon law on parishes, and it was an elective, very good elective, and nobody signed up for it. and I said, well, I says, aren't you guys interested in this? And they said, well, we are, but we have so few electives to choose from that there are some other electives that we really feel we need. And, you know, an elective on effective youth ministry, an elective on scriptures, so that you better homilist, things like that. So It wasn't that they didn't see the value of it, but there were other things that called out to them at that point in time for their own ministry. And, of course, 20 years ago, you might be pastor for, you might be an associate pastor, at least in the Diocese of Cleveland, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
We are now finding it's not uncommon in the Diocese of Cleveland, which is much larger than the Diocese of Grand Rapids, that you will have priests being assigned as pastors after 5-6 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, of course, that's far different here in Grand Rapids, where you could get assigned as a pastor after 2 years. And so I don't think that there's a lot of formalized training in that regard.
Okay.
Certainly, when I was involved in the Cleveland Diocese, they would have workshops for priests that they invited to it who seemed like they would be becoming pastors in the next few years. Mm-hmm. And we would try to give them all of those components, at least introduce them to those components.
Right.
I don't know that we have that that luxury here in Grand Rapids. And then, so you can see how important it is to find good advisors. If you're a young pastor, inexperienced, first of all, you certainly want to talk to your brother pastors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I did. You know, what do I do with this? I can't, you know, what, I don't know how to handle this, or what's the best way to approach it? And many priests will very humbly but beneficially share their experience with you, things that worked, things that didn't work, and really help the young pastor, the new pastor, to avoid making some mistakes that otherwise could have been avoided. So one of the first things you do is you talk to your brother pastors who are priests. But also, I found it was extremely invaluable to find people in the parish who could also advise.
Exactly.
I mean, you have people who have expertise at human resources. You have people who have expertise in budgeting and things like that. And so the pastor, as long as he can find out, you know, people who know and consult them will be on pretty good grounds. And, of course, he learns as he goes along. There's an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So I think there is definitely a learning curve for our pastors, but I think there's lots of resources if they reach out and make use of them.
Yeah.
So I feel some confidence, at least my own experience, taught me that don't try to figure things out on your own from scratch. Call somebody and say, you know, here's a situation I have in the school. Here's something that came up on Paris Council. Here's something I want to do. You know, do I get 3 bids for this job, or what kind of insurance do I need?
Exactly.
And things like that. And so, you know, things begin to repeat. You begin to develop, if you will, a repertoire of mm-hmm. skills. And you become in your own way, you know, a good pastor, a wise pastor.
So what you're really saying, too, is we don't need to reinvent the wheel and become a pastor because it's been done before. And if you rely on people who've had that experience, you'll be far better served in really helping that out. You know, but I would be willing to bet you, Bishop, that if you went back to those people that where that course was offered to today, they'd say, you know, I think I might take that now. I think I would have taken that as an elective because it really would have been something that would have helped me. But hindsight, as we know, is always 20/20. But so here you are in this parish now for another 10 years, correct? About 10 years?
We're a bishop?
Yeah. No, as a priest, as a parish priest.
I was there for 7 years.
7 years.
And the retirement age in Cleveland for priests is 75, which
okay.
is a little bit higher than here.
Okay.
So I was looking forward to another 15 years as the pastor there. And, after 7 years, you get to know people well. You get to be able to identify their skills,
right.
Their level of energy, their degree of connectedness to the mission of the church. And so you begin to assemble teams. You begin to see areas where there can be an outreach in new ministries and things like that. So it was a very exciting point to be at. I think we were really getting some momentum going.
Yeah.
Because it takes a while to get to know people. It takes a while to be able not only to know them, but then to see how they can be helpful and to see how you can use some of the ideas
yeah.
that they come up with that can be put into practice.
Exactly.
We had some very creative people that did start up some very wonderful ministries in the parish. And the thing is to be able to listen and to enable that to happen. So I was thinking that the new assignment to Michigan kind of stopped all of that in its tracks. But I really believe, though, that after a year, and even after agreeing to accept the appointment, that I felt at peace with it that this was what I was supposed to be doing, and I was not. I really was not anxious about it. I was much more anxious in becoming a pastor than I was at becoming a bishop.
Praise be to God. Now, you're coming up. Have you reached your first anniversary, or is it coming up soon?
June 18th.
I'm sorry?
June 18th.
June 18th. We're coming up very quickly. For the people that are listening to us, again, I want to let our listeners know this is Deacon Jim Thorndale. This is Holy Family Radio. And I am with Bishop David Bolkovia here, the Bishop of Diocese of Grand Rapids. Bishop, I want to go back to something we were just talking about. Did you have any idea that you were being considered as a bishop?
No. No. The lists are formulated by the bishops of a given state called a province, and everybody is under secrecy. I mean, in Michigan here, the bishops gather and compile lists and consider priests who would, we think, be decent candidates for becoming a bishop.
Okay.
But we don't say a word about that to anybody. It's absolute secret, and I had to get on somebody's list somewhere, and nobody talks. So that was not known to me. I would say that, you know, over the years, given my background with a degree in canon law, having worked in the chancery and the seminary, that people thought I might have some of the characteristics that would lead me to be put on a list like that, but there was no verification of that. So I really didn't. Wasn't thinking about it. It came out of the blue. I had been out of those specialized ministries of seminary and chancery for 7 years. I was a pastor for 7 years, and I was pretty well settled, if you will, not in a bad way, but very, very comfortable and very happy to be the head of a parish. And that was my goal, that was my life, and that was my joy.
Yeah.
So, no, I really, the came was just, it was stunning. You know, I just, when I got that call, it was, I just wasn't expecting it.
And you know, the reason I ask these questions, too, is because Catholics need to hear the process, and some don't understand that process. When you got the call, you have the full right and privilege to decline that?
You do. And I have no idea how often that happens. I know it does happen. But just as Bishop Pilla asked me to study canon law, and I had no good reason to say no, I felt the same way here. The Apostolic Nuncio calls you on the phone and says, I have good news. Pope Francis has appointed you to be Bishop of Grand Rapids. So for me to say no to that, now obviously Pope Francis didn't know me. He'd only been Pope for 13 days, and the assignment had been in the pipeline, if you will, under Pope Benedict. Okay. But somebody here thought that I might have the characteristics to be helpful in being a bishop. Evidently, that was considered. The names were sent over to the Congregation for Bishops, and they considered the names. There's three on the list, and they must have felt that I was a good fit for Grand Rapids. So when you think about all of this, on what grounds would I say no? Yeah. It would be self-centered.
Exactly.
I like it here. I'm comfortable being a pastor. We're really moving in the right direction. My family is here. My friends here. I'm an Ohioan.
Yeah.
All of those things are all about me, me, me.
By the way,
I know. I know. People have been very, very welcoming. And believe me, the culture, the Midwest culture is very, very seamless, at least between Ohio and Michigan.
Yeah.
It's a very good fit for me personally.
Exactly.
So when I looked those things over, I felt it was the right thing to do, to say yes. And I would wonder right now, I think that if I had said no, that would have a very corrosive effect on my soul.
Yeah.
Wondering, you know, what did the Lord have planned for me, and why did I say no to this, and
exactly.
Things like that. Always better off, you know, if your superiors in the church ask you to do something, best to cooperate. You have to somehow give the Holy Spirit some credit in this process. And you have to rely on the people and their assessment, their judgments of things, and, of course, how can we best cooperate? Yeah. This wasn't anything that I thought of, but somebody thinks it might be beneficial and helpful for the church. So I'm very glad that I said yes, and I really didn't hesitate. I think I was just too shocked to, you know, to process it right away. But and it was for me, it was the right decision. There's no going back. I'm very happy here. I think I can do some good here. I think I can put my abilities to good use here, and I feel very supported here. Yeah.
Well, if it's any help, we're glad you said yes, too, because it's been wonderful to have you here. But let me ask you this. Did you take a big gulp when you'd have to go to your parish and tell them that you were being sent to Grand Rapids? Was it difficult to go to your parish and have that conversation?
It was very interesting because I was told of the appointment on March 26th. And, of course, Easter was that coming Sunday. So this was during Holy Week. The day after Holy Week, the day after Easter, I was taking some parishioners on a trip to France because it was the 50th anniversary of the parish of St. Joan of Arc. So we went to Normandy, and we retraced some of the important spots in Joan of Arc's life. It was a wonderful trip. So we delayed the announcement till I got back from that trip. So I went on, you know, I got the phone call, told nobody, went to France for about 12 days, told nobody, was back home for a few more days, and nobody knew until they got the press announcement in Cleveland that I was named bishop because we were under secrecy.
Your bishop would have known, though.
Oh, sure. They're informed what's coming up, but they keep that secret.
Right.
And I did not... I did not tell my family till the night before.
How did they handle it?
So I called them from Grand Rapids. I drove in on Wednesday night. I called them. And then, you know, Thursday at 10 o'clock, I had the news conference. Well, you can imagine getting a call in the evening. They were as stunned as I probably was when I was told. They really almost didn't know how to react. The one who reacted the best was my dad. He said, well, congratulations, I'm very proud of you, and all that. And then the next time I saw him, he was crying. I said, what are you crying for? I said, you were so happy. He says, now I realize you're going to be leaving Ohio and going away. But he's fine with it now because he understands, you know, most Catholics understand what a bishop does.
Right.
And so he has an idea of what I'm doing, and I think he appreciates the importance of it. And he's 92.
Yeah.
And I would like to get back and see him more often.
Of course.
I've got to try to plan for that. But so it was a shock to the family. It was a shock to everybody. Obviously, who's not shocked? Maybe not the same intensity, but at least surprise.
Right.
There's surprise with my friends and family and things like that.
And they do say, parting is such sweet sorrow. It was a sweet sorrow for your father, I'm sure. His son was moving away.
Well, that is true. I mean, my three sisters live within about 15 minutes of where he lives.
Yeah.
So that's a very wonderful thing, you know, as he's grown older. But we all adjust. This is where I'm supposed to be, and I think we're all at peace with it. And I think we're all fairly happy, you know, as a family. We're still close.
I think of that. I think your father raised you to be a bishop. He didn't know it at the time, but through your teaching and his catechesis for you, he put on that beautiful understanding of your Catholic faith.
Right. My mother, too. My mother died roughly, she will have died 15 years ago in December, but she was a wonderful woman of faith. You know, Eucharistic minister. She was in the Ladies' Guild. She helped out in the sacristy. She was a member of the Christ Child Society. So her faith was extremely important to her. My grandparents, everybody. You know, I had two or three priest relatives.
Yeah.
So religion was very important in our family. And so there's just a really wonderful environment to support the announcement of a vocation, for example. It was greeted with joy. Today it's not always greeted with joy by parents.
Right.
One of the things parents want is they want their children to be happy. And they wonder whether their son could be happy, you know, as a priest, or whether their son or daughter could be happy living in common in religious life.
Yeah.
The answer, of course, is yes. But parents want the best for their children. And so I think they see both sides of any choice that's being made.
And, you know, Bishop, the reality is, too, we have a family with a smaller amount of children. And so sometimes they only have one son, and they feel like they're giving them up to the church rather than having the experience of being a grandparent or something like that, where sometimes they don't hear the call like the son does. So, you know, it's a tough situation.
Well, that's very true. The other thing is that I think it's very hard to discern a vocation to religious life or ordained ministry if you're not going to Mass and you're not close to the Eucharist.
Yes.
What we find now is 20 to 25% of our families are going to Mass and close to the Eucharist. But that has really shrunken the available number of families where the children might consider a vocation.
Yeah.
If three out of four families are coming sporadically to church and receiving communion, it's just hard for me to understand how somebody would want to be a priest and the Eucharist wouldn't be just a key component of their spiritual life.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is also the fact that fewer people are attending the sacraments.
Amen.
Is also a factor, as well as, you know, fewer children. When you have eight or nine kids, of course, one or two, three want to be in religious life, fine. But there's a very natural desire to be a grandparent.
Yeah. Maybe.
And a very natural desire, you know, again, for your son or daughter to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, you know, the church has gone through some rough times,
mm-hmm.
and it has been challenging to be a priest. I have nothing but the utmost respect and admiration for our seminarians.
Amen.
And for those who are in pursuing a vocation in religious life, for their courageous witness to their faith and their willing to lay down their life for the Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it's all about. And, you know, amazingly, I don't think we see an upward spike in vocations. Perhaps they've leveled off. But I'm just very, very encouraged by young people who are, one almost might say, fearless.
Yeah.
In proclaiming Christ by the way they live and what they choose to do.
You know, Bishop, I think another thing important, at least for me as a man and for young boys, is, and I know I was an altar server, I'm sure you probably were an altar server one time, is for our young men to be back in the sacristy with our priests and seeing what goes on and who they are and getting a little more intimate with the understanding of what the priesthood is. And that's just, you know, I'm not saying the women shouldn't be altar servers, but what I'm saying is we have to have the young men cathecting to that type of relationship to see the priest and what he does in that time.
If you never see a priest, you have no idea what their life is like, and why would you be called to it?
Exactly.
I mean, it sometimes happens, more frequently than not, that a son or daughter sees what their mother or father are doing for a living and for a profession, and how often it is that you might have someone who's an electrician, they might have one or two sons who become electricians.
Right.
Or you might have a mother who's a teacher and their children are attracted to education, a career in education. And so as a result, they see what the life is like.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't see what the life is like, it's pretty hard to be drawn to it.
It is.
And so I think that's a good point. And that's the importance, first of all, of coming to church, being involved in the church, and then, if at all possible, you know, getting to know the priest.
Yeah. I know this for a fact, that the two seminarians, one from my church and Robert Muldring's son, both were altar servers. I mean, it was vitally important to them in their lives to really be up on the altar with the priest and to be back in the sacristy, to really be witness to and what it meant to be in a priestly vocation. And so I see the extreme value to that in young men today. So I hope that our listeners will encourage their sons to be at least become altar servers and be open up to the Lord and maybe hear his call.
When I was pastor, I used to really affirm our high school servers, because what I would find is in great number that a lot of them after eighth grade and they went to high school would stop serving.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always make a pitch for them to stay. And I have to say that in personally going into the classrooms and asking them to continue to be of help to me and to the other priest and to the parish, a lot of them generously responded and continued on. Maybe not through senior year, but they did.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, our high school servers are the gold plate blue chip servers. They have a dignity and a liturgical air about them to
yes.
where they're not ruffled. They don't show that they don't know what they're doing. They're more focused. They help the congregation to be prayerful.
Yes.
And so I would always, I always was very, very grateful, especially for high school students that continued to serve right on through. That's not to say that the younger ones, of course, have the enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And the older servers, of course, are, you know, as we see in the high school years, you know, there's a big difference between a freshman in high school and a junior or senior in high school.
Huge.
They mature. But they have a beautiful maturity about them, and they have they're responsible, and they're just a real joy to have around. And so I always tried to encourage people to stay on as long as they felt they could. Yeah. Obviously, there are growing encroachments on even Sunday morning, you know, sports practices, travel teams.
Yeah.
There were all kinds of things, even some athletic meets. So there was competition for what was going on Sunday morning, but it was a real gift for our young people to continue to come. And I think that those kind of experiences, I think, really do help young people to continue on with their faith. You know, they have to make a big decision.
Yep.
When they leave home. And they have an incredible amount of freedom as freshmen on a campus to look into the Catholic campus ministry or to find the nearest church. And if that can be done early on, there's a good chance that it will take hold and remain. But if nobody reaches out to them in those first few weeks, oftentimes their schedule gets locked in and set. Patterns of are formed, and then they're less likely to attend Mass except when they come home for vacations.
Yeah. You know, another thing I encourage, we have some high school servers, is I encourage them to understand that they're witnessing to other kids their age into their dedication to stay on the altar. And it really is a beautiful witness to the Catholic faith saying, this is important to me, and I need to be here.
We had a server who was the quarterback on the public high school football team, was looked up to by many, not only because he was 6'6", but he continued to serve through his senior year.
Oh, wonderful.
And we even got an alb long enough for him so he wouldn't look ridiculous wearing a small alb. So we bought one or two to fit tall servers, and sometimes, of course, if a server didn't show up, another one came to volunteer. It might be a fifth or sixth grader that basically came up to his belt or something
exactly.
like that. So, but he gave, in a sense, he gave permission for others who looked up to him that this was something that wasn't weird to do. And we had a very good number of high school servers from our public high school in town that stayed with it all the way through. And when you have leaders in their schools and people who are very talented and gifted, and they continue to see value and want to serve, obviously that has effect on the other young people who are watching and who are attending Mass.
I like what you said. It gives them permission.
Mm-hmm.
And young people need that. They need to be given that permission to be who they are. And that's really what he was doing. So that's a wonderful thought. So just for a minute or two again, we didn't finish up on your parish. Were they joyful that you had this opportunity? Did you leave with, were they had much trepidation when you left, or not sure what the future was going to hold for them?
I think they were happy. Of course, they were sad too. I mean, mm-hmm. whenever a priest leaves, there are people who will miss him.
Right.
Because whether the pastor or the associate pastor, you relate very well to certain people. I mean, I was a pastor, I had associates, and there were people who really resonated with the other priest, and thank God for that, and were really saddened when they left, and they were, I suppose it was the same way with me.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were very happy for me. I think they saw it as a promotion. Many of them said we're not surprised, but they did get a good pastor after me, and I believe they may have known about that before I left.
Yeah.
And it was somebody who was very well known to me. It was the associate pastor. So that relieved them a lot. So they didn't have a lot of angst.
Wonderful.
Over who would be coming, because I think rather quickly they announced the priest would be succeeding me, and he'd already been there for 2 years.
Exactly.
So he was a known entity.
Okay.
And they liked him.
Wonderful. Well, now we have you, and we're thanks be to God we have you here. And I don't want to run out of time, and I've got some other issues I'd like to, or questions I'd like to get to you too. But Bishop, you know, one of the questions I'm asking here is obviously you had to get your feet wet first when you came into the diocese, never having been a bishop, but you had to come in with some goals and aspirations after you looked at the diocese. Was there something you were looking at particularly when you came in?
Well, my first attitude to respect the work and the accomplishments of the Church of Grand Rapids had gone before me. You know, Bishop Hurley welcomed me in a very wonderful way. Yeah. Bishop Hurley has remained a wise counselor and friend, and I'm really indebted to him for his work, his ministry as a bishop for nearly 8 years in our diocese. Same thing with Bishop Rose. Yeah. I can see the positive effects of their episcopal leadership, you know, as I grow to know the diocese more and more, because people will tell me the background. They'll say Bishop Rose did this or that, or it was Bishop Hurley that had this idea, mm-hmm. or whatnot. And so I can see how I am the beneficiary of their grace-inspired leadership. So the first thing was to build upon and respect what I found here. The first thing was to know what it was I was finding here. So mm-hmm. I have spent the first year trying to learn as much as I could, trying to extend myself to go to as many events and to be available and accessible to as many people as I can. And I'm glad I took that approach, because issues are coming into sharper focus for me, so that the foundations have been laid, we continue to build on and move forward. And I think that our faith, our future, was a wonderful pastoral plan looking to the future. I think we need to continue to work to energize and revitalize our parishes in the great work of evangelization.
Right.
The last three popes, you know, Pope St. John Paul II, Benedict, and now Francis, have all stressed the new evangelization, which really is witnessing to the faith, living faith in a joyful, vibrant way, being willing to share that faith with others, and thus leading others to an encounter with the Lord Jesus.
Yes.
We really need to do that. And so I'm very interested in supporting the parishes as best we can, you know, going forward in their priorities and their missions based off our faith and our future. I think together with that, when you're talking about evangelization, the most successful means of evangelization that the Church has created is our Catholic schools. And so our Catholic schools are a treasure and a very high priority for me. So I've been spending a lot of time thinking and working with others to see how we can strengthen and make our good schools even better for the days ahead. I think this is very important. It's important for vocations.
Exactly.
It's important for vocations if we want people to staff our parishes, if we want the religious vocations to continue to give witness to the wonderful ministries and apostolates that our religious are involved in. Catholic education is important in that.
Exactly.
In helping people to develop a relationship to God and a generous spirit of following the Lord. And, of course, I think it's also important that we always, you know, look to our works of charity. We can never forget. You know, the Lord seems to say in the 25th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, that whatever you do to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it to me. And, of course, there are things that are very simple. They're not sophisticated things, but feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving mm-hmm. drink to the thirsty, visiting those who are sick or in prison. These are the things that we need to do. It's important to meet people's needs, but it's also important to try to give them an opportunity to improve their living
exactly.
situations. Yeah. So I think that works of charity is also important. I'm very impressed with the Catholic Charities of West Michigan. I want to continue to see how we can reach out to those who are in our midst, as well as, you know, thinking about new areas where the Church needs to be involved in. You know, one of the things that is becoming more and more apparent is the great scourge, if you will, of human trafficking.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that in our own state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do to help people who are literally enslaved in patterns of living which don't respect their dignity as a human being made in the image and likeness of God? So that's just an example of things that we need to do. I also think we have a wonderful gift in the fact that one out of every three Catholics in our diocese are Hispanic in origin. And I really want to make sure that we are serving our Latino brothers and sisters well, and that we do all that we can to continue the very wonderful, strong, and vibrant faith that they brought with them, you know, to this, this state.
Yes.
They are, the family life is so strong. They have so much that we, if you want to say Americans, but I know that that's not the right term, but we, maybe Yankees or cultural Americans can learn and really benefit from by joining with them closer and making them even more a vibrant part of our church and our future. This really has to go forward.
Exactly.
Because they're such an important and valued part of who we are as church.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to your talk about our Catholic education. I was privileged to be able to be part of Catholic Schools Week with Holy Family Radio and talk to some of our principals and everything. And we all emphasize the same thing. The best gift you can give your child is a Catholic education. And there are ways and means that people can see the value to it and also be able to afford it today. So I think that really is a wonderful thought of our Catholic education, because it really ties into a lot of what you're talking about, Christian charity. When we have that Catholic attitude, we begin to see the poor. We begin to see the least among us. And that really kind of ties into what you're saying right now. And then it should tie into that human trafficking, which is a terrible scourge in our country. And pray be to God, we're looking at it. But so I thank you for those visions you're talking about now.
Yeah, one thing I would like to say is,
sure,
though, I would certainly like to affirm, you know, families whose children are not going to Catholic schools, that you can have very wonderful, strong, devout, faith-filled sons and daughters by parents taking the lead in sharing their faith with their children.
Yes.
We certainly see this in our homeschool families, but also in those who go to public and private schools. I mean, if it's a priority for mom and dad, it will be a priority for their sons and daughters. And so I certainly, just referring back to my own experience as pastor in Ohio, we had about 200 kids in our school. But the vast majority of our young Catholic parishioner students did not go to our grade school. And we had some just magnificent examples of faith in our families and our children. So what I would like to say is it's very important that we offer this. It has a lot of built-in advantages because of the faith environment, without a doubt. I certainly wouldn't want to say that, the Catholic education is a great way to do that. It can be done in other ways. So I certainly want to salute those whose children are in public schools, private schools, who are very much interested and engaged in their children's faith development, because that's, after all, the most important thing. And I do want to also acknowledge those who are homeschooling their children. I have been very impressed with the families and the students that I have met who are being homeschooled. So I just wanted to make sure that I could say
that. Thank
you.
I appreciate that. That is wonderful, because there are a lot in there who are struggling and who need to hear that encouragement. So here you are in Grand Rapids. You're talking about your goals and aspirations. What was one of your biggest struggles, if you don't mind me asking that? What was one of your biggest struggles when you first came into the diocese? Did you have one?
I don't recall any traumatic events or struggles. I mean, Bishop Hurley had pretty well cleared the decks, if you will.
Okay.
I mean, I think he knew he was going to be retiring within a year, and he really left the diocese in excellent shape.
Great.
And so he made a lot of tough decisions during his time as bishop, and I'm very grateful to him because I feel that it's just a wonderful place to continue to grow on his work and his vision. I would say a couple of things. Obviously, when you're dealing with people, this is very important and it can be very challenging. So you might say human resources. I think that, you know, there's people who write in, there's people who come to see me, you know, there's people who are employed by the church in some capacity. Often, when you're dealing with people and their lives, that has to be treated, you know, with a great deal of care and compassion. And there are some difficult things that sometimes happen. I found this also as pastor. It was really dealing with personnel that proved to be very challenging, but it was very important to do so as best we could. Mm-hmm. And so I can't say that we've had a crisis in that, but I always find human resources and things to be a challenge, to respect people, to try to do what's best in the long run. The other thing is the volume of work. Not so much the work itself, but the volume of emails, phone calls, letters, things that come in on different levels now. You know, the province of Michigan, the state of Michigan, the nationwide, the bishops' conference. You know, even the Universal Church, as well as events in the diocese. So there's just a lot more things to juggle and to try to address. I wouldn't say that's a crisis.
Okay.
As the piles continue to grow on my desk. But in any case, I would say those were some of the biggest challenges. I felt very blessed that I think I've had a pretty good first year, and I really can't point to anything that really stands out in my mind as, oh, yes, this was really difficult or hard or whatnot.
Hopefully you felt welcomed by the Diocese of Grand Rapids when you came in.
Oh, absolutely. I continue to feel that. Yeah. Absolutely. And people really love West Michigan.
Yeah.
They are very proud and of West Michigan and all the things that it has to offer. I mean, the Grand Rapids area is certainly an area that has a lot of positive energy.
Had you been here before, prior to being
here? I was here once, and believe it or not, I was here as a tourist.
Okay.
I had come to see the Gerald Ford Museum and the City Museum and spend a day with a good priest friend of mine coming through here as one stop of a number on a short trip.
Okay.
So I very much liked what I saw, but never envisioned that I would be returning here as a resident.
Yeah. It's a wonderful town. It's since then, you know, I've grown up here, and it's such an amazing change in our whole area. It's just been beautiful, and I hope you feel that way too when you come over here too, because we got beautiful Lake Michigan, not probably as close as what Erie was to you, but you are about 20-25 minutes away from it right now for Lake Michigan.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I love the Great Lakes, and so as someone who lived most of his life very close to Lake Erie, to come to a state that is touched by four of the five Great Lakes. Yeah. Is just a very wonderful thing to contemplate. And so I'm probably least familiar with the shore of Lake Michigan on the, you know, the west side of the state, more familiar with the Lake Huron shoreline and also the Upper Peninsula, Lake Superior, and that. So and I'm really looking forward. I'm hoping to have some time this summer to just drive along the coastline and enjoy the beauty of the dunes and the various towns along the way.
And I hope you notice we have some nice golf courses along the way there, too.
Too many. I can't complete them all before my earthly days are done. I think there's 800 golf courses in Michigan. One. If I golf 50 a year when I retire, I'll still have 50 left to do.
We'll
I don't think we'll make it. Yeah. But the golf here is wonderful. Golf in Ohio is very good, too.
Yes, I've golfed.
But the nice thing with all these courses is hopefully I should be able to move around the course and not get stuck for 7 or 8 hours out there.
Bishop, for the little bit of time we have left, I'm compelled because I'm a deacon. I have to ask this question if you're so inclined to answer it. But what's the vision for the diaconate now here in Grand Rapids?
I was very much used to and familiar with diaconal ministry back in Ohio. When I became pastor of St. Joan of Arc, I had three deacons on the staff. For many, many years, part of my teaching assignment were to teach the permanent deacons their canon law. So I was very familiar with the diaconate, and the very positive aspects of diaconal ministry in the Diocese of Cleveland. I certainly think that is true even now. We have 37, 38 deacons who are working diligently in their ministry of the Word, the altar, and charity. And I would like to see that continue to grow and to flourish. I also think that we have an opportunity now, especially after Our Faith, Our Future, to tailor the deacon's ministry to really fit the very specific needs that continue to be more sharply identified within our 11-county area.
Okay.
So I think that that's very, very important. And I have appointed, you know, Father Mark Shibish as the director for the formation and diaconal program. And so we are, first of all, at this point, we are looking to the deacons we already have to support them in their ministry and to acknowledge their ministry and to make sure that that they feel affirmed, really, in the great work that they're doing. This, of course, means that we are going to begin putting together a program for pursuing, once again, the acknowledgement of diaconal vocations resulting in ordinations.
Right.
So that is unfolding even as we speak. We're looking at that.
You, Bishop, will be instrumental in helping with that formation program and how it puts together?
Yes, I would think so. In terms of how it's structured, in terms of whether or not I'm an actual instructor down the road, I doubt it.
Right.
But as far as the curriculum goes. Well, yes, as Bishop, I have to be involved and want to be involved in tailoring and shaping the way that diaconal ministry will be experienced and utilized in our local church.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that again is because it's a mysterious ministry to many people, and I want them to have an understanding that you are the linchpin, you're the key to that ministry, and that's why I asked the question whether you'd be personally involved, because I don't think people really realize how integral the ministry is to the bishop. And so we thank you for that. That's a great answer, and I think it inspires a lot of men listening today to understand that that opportunity, if they're hearing God's call, to come back into that understanding of diaconate is open again. Plans, we got a couple minutes left. Bishop, plans for the future. Anything in particular that we're thinking that we on the forefront right now that you want to talk about?
More immediately, of course, I want to continue to visit the parishes.
Okay.
I got stymied by winter and realize now, I mean, one of the great learnings is to realize what winters in Grand Rapids are like. Although people tell me it was not a typical winter.
No.
But I think we got more snow here than... And I lived in the snow belt southeast of Cleveland in Chagrin Falls. We got a lot of snow. And but I think this is more snow than I remember. And so we'll see what happens next year.
Yeah.
So I'm very much interested. For example, tomorrow I will be going up to Ludington to St. Simon Parish and visit the school there, and looking forward to that very much.
Yeah.
And realize now that the best thing to do is to try to reach the northern parishes during the summer and
fall,
as opposed to just forget it in the winter.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I really want to do, is to continue to meet and to visit all of our schools and all of our parishes.
Yes.
But then again, there are, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there are a number of things that are, if you will, on my mind. The diaconate program, Hispanic ministry, strengthening our schools, strengthening Catholic charities.
Yes.
And, you know, really giving our parishes every opportunity to really put together an evangelization invitation that will help draw others to encounter the risen Lord.
Bishop, I want to thank you for being here. It's it seemed like the hour went so fast, but we so much appreciate your ministry here, your being the bishop here and leading the flock, because it's a tremendous joy for us to have you here. And we as a diocese are going to continue to pray for you in your ministry, that the Lord will continue to bless you and keep you as the shepherd that you are to our diocese. So thank you for being here, and I hope we can extend the invitation that you would return to us again and maybe have another conversation one day, and whatever it is that is on your mind.
I'd be happy to do it, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bishop. God bless.
You've been listening to Living the Catholic Life with your host, Deacon Jim Thorndale, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Thank you for listening.